Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfort. As the summer winds down, it's time to survey one of the worst years of salmon fishing in memory in South Central Alaska. The Susitna drainage was expected to be poor and was worse. Kenai kingfishing continued the bad trend of the last 10 years, and Cook Inlet sockeye numbers were the worst seen in many decades. On today's show, we'll review what happened, review the state of knowledge about why it happened, and talk about the impact on anglers and communities. We'll also get into predictions of the future and what we need to know to go from here. The ocean survival of salmon is a big area of questions that has left us much in the dark. So for the first half of the show, I'll be joined by Matt Miller of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, who had to make many hard calls this summer, closing fisheries and limiting gear to conserve fish in the river. Matt will also touch on research and predictions for the future. The good news is he doesn't think this is the new normal. After that, we'll have a piece from Kodiak about similar problems related to ocean temperatures with the crash of cod fisheries. And then in our final section, I'm joined by Ricky Geese of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. Ricky actually thinks Fish and Game should have shut down more streams and shut them down sooner, as his group hopes to someday rebuild salmon fisheries that have been struggling for a long time. He'll also talk about the serious impact on Kenai Peninsula communities that have had to deal with restrictions and move to a new economic base. That's all coming up on Outdoor Explorer, the outdoor magazine from Alaska Public Media. We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is a pretty serious one that has a lot of people concerned, specifically Kenai River fish, and I think we'll probably broaden out to the whole Kenai Peninsula. What happened to the salmon this summer? They didn't show up in the way we expect them to. A lot of closures, a lot of disappointment, and a lot of economic impact. So we're going to take that big topic, and we're going to talk to someone who is right in the middle of it. I was just talking with him and saying, boy, you've had a tough summer, haven't you? Matt Miller is a regional fisheries management coordinator for Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And Matt responded, a lot of people have had a tough summer. And that's very true, isn't it, Matt? It's been a very unusual one.
Oh, yeah, it has been. It's been, starting when I had the pleasure to come in and talk to you this spring.
About the Susitna.
The Susitna closures that we had there. And then, king salmon throughout Cook Inlet and followed up with sockeye numbers like we haven't seen for 30, 40 years. So, yeah, definitely it's been unusual and tough for a lot of people.
Right. So the kings have been kind of AWOL sort of throughout cooking that a lot of Southeast Alaska. Is there anywhere that kings, that's sort of a big question mark, and kings are sort of like the king. It seems like that's almost a statewide issue, yes?
Oh, it is. And that's a good reminder because people kind of get focused on their fisheries, but it's much larger than the Kenai or from Susitna drainages. It's really a statewide issue that we're seeing.
Yeah, and then in addition, the sockeye were a big disappointment, but that's been more inconsistent around the state.
Yeah, that's for sure. We're talking about this the other day, and places out in Bristol Bay, which I wasn't following that closely, but Wood River, I know in one day one of the drainages out there had nearly doubled its daily passage record. I think they had 1.13 million sockeye.
Unbelievable.
And that's with the fleet out front. Yeah, it was crazy. And then even inconsistently, so we had that and some of the drainages in Bristol Bay and then some of the east side drainages were lagging behind, and I think they eventually caught up. But even amongst a place like Bristol Bay, it wasn't real consistent. So it's just been bizarre.
Has timing been unusual this year as well? I've heard some stuff about timing. Chignik, I think, was so the run is, that's obviously not a sport fishery, but I'm not sure if the timing has been normal.
You know, there were some places statewide where sockeye weren't showing up. People were getting a little bit nervous, and then they'd come through. More specifically to Cook Inlet, I don't think the timing has been as much as an issue as it had been sometimes in other years.
Just absence of fish is
just
the issue.
Just the absence of fish,
yeah. So in terms of the fish that our listeners would be going after, their sport fishing listeners, let's go through each of those and sort of talk about what happened. And I guess the sort of the cream of the crop is always Kenai River Kings. Yeah. And that's essentially been just about zeroed out this year, right? I mean, just nothing happening.
Yeah, it's interesting because with what we were seeing in June when we first start seeing Cook Inlet King Salmon come back up was really low numbers. You know, preseason, the department comes up with a forecast of what we expect to see, and then we kind of manage off that until we see real fish in river and can look at the fish. And it became evident there in June that we were not seeing, everyone was underproducing what we had forecast. And I mean, Cook Inlet wide, from Anchor, Deep, the Nilchik, Kasilov, the Kenai, Little Sioux, Susitna, all of them had underproduced. And so restrictions were put in place and closures in many places in June. And then we got into the late run, which is really the bulk of what people think of with that Kenai Kenai King fishery.
So the bigger fish used to come from the late run, yes?
Yeah. I think actually the record came from the early run. I'd have to go back and check. But there had been some, you know, really big fish, but it's a larger run.
Right.
And so there's more of them, and so it's more popular then. So we started out in July. Our forecast said, yeah, you're probably going to make the goal. We have an escapement goal for that run of 13,500 to 27,000 kings, and we're trying to shoot for a goal within that for the kings. And our forecast was saying, yeah, we're going to make it right in there. But from what we had seen in June, we kind of stepped out in July 1. We started without bait. So we started the season out without restrictions. But, you know, really most anglers had seen what happened in June. They were fine with that. They were still able to harvest fish, gave the opportunity to go out and fish. So, you know, people really understood that.
And then how did it develop from then on?
Yeah, so then we started looking, and I think it was around the 15th. It was about the middle of July. We said, well, we're tracking behind where we'd like to see. And our main assessment, we have several indices of king salmon on the Kenai, but our biggest one is the sonar program that we have. And the fish were lagging behind what we wanted to see. And so then about the middle of the month, we went to we went from no bait down to catch and release and fished that through the season. So.
And that was catch and release and keep it in the water, so you don't even really get a picture, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. There's several restrictions that go along with catch and releases. They're just part of the best practices. And if we typically, we won't have catch and release with bait fisheries. And so it's single hook, artificial lure, don't remove the fish from the water. But again, it still allowed businesses to operate. It still brought some of that economy to Kenai and Soldotna, and still allowed people to go out and have a nice day on the river. And there were some really nice kings coming in at the end of July from the folks that we heard from that were out fishing. Really beautiful big fish coming in. So people were pleased to see that.
So overall, did you feel like, obviously we have to think about the future and the fish that are going to be coming back 4 or 5 years from now. Did we make the goal, or did enough fish get upriver that we can sort of hope that, at least in terms of escapement, it's not going to be a conservation problem in the future?
Yeah, so for the early run, for the Kenai specifically, and actually it's largely the case through many of the Cook Inlet systems, we weren't making goals for that early run for those June fish. For the Kenai, we currently are up to about 15,300. And so we're going to make the goal for there, and that's even allowing for some of that harvest that had happened up above the sonar. So the restrictions helped, and we're going to make the goal there. It's kind of interesting because we start looking at you know, the reasons for this, which is really the big question. And with the king specifically, what it looks like is that there's one of the major age classes that just didn't show up.
Wow.
And so you know, the kings will spend their freshwater time, and then they smolt, go out into the ocean, and spend 2 to 5 years in the Kenai out in the marine environment before they return to the river. And I think it was three and four ocean fish. I think mostly the fours. We just saw way fewer of them coming back than we had forecast or anticipated. So kind of suggesting that something in that marine environment was negatively impacting them. And that's
something 4 years ago or something between the, I mean, because if it would have been the whole basin, presumably it would hit more than one age class, right?
Yeah, but I don't think we really know enough about where these fish are going when they go out there. You know, if they're going out by age classes, they might be going out to different parts of the Gulf or different parts of the ocean when they're rearing out there. So, you know, we've had different conditions. Obviously, it brings up, so why? Why would it impact one age class? So if we are saying, well, it hit hatchery fish and wild fish, and some of the studies we might have talked about this last time down in Southeast were suggesting that in Southeast anyway, there was a higher mortality as these kings were smolting in those first months to years that they were spending in the nearshore environment seemed to be when they had that higher mortality. So what, you know, what would that be? We know out in the Gulf we've had concentrated warmer waters, how that impacts, and we don't know.
So that warm blob could have been the problem?
It could have been. I'm not going to call it that, but I'm going to call it concentrated warm waters in the Gulf. That certainly is going to impact them. I mean, it's going to impact plankton. Mm-hmm. It's going to benefit some kinds of plankton, and it's going to be to a detriment to other kinds, you know, and so that's going to benefit some fish and not others. That could have meant that the fish were moving to different places to get to cooler water. It could have been impacting the food source. It could have been introducing predators that we typically don't see this far north. So maybe we're seeing, you know, more southern warmer fish are coming up. There's also been some discussion lately at the board level and amongst people about potential effects from hatchery releases. And are we getting to the point where we're impacting the wild stocks out in the ocean in the Gulf?
So in other words, that's kind of a carrying capacity issue. If you're releasing so many mouths into the marine environment, maybe those pinks that you're releasing are eating all the food, and the sockeye and the king and chinook are not, silvers are not getting them.
Right. That could either be, as you had suggested, food, competing for food, or it could be that, you know, if you have so many pinks out there that it's increasing other predators because they have easy food for us.
Oh,
once they move off the pinks, they go someplace else. But, you know, so there's a lot of what ifs.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, researchers are trying to look at all of those rather than trying to pinpoint or look at any one in particular thing.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking today about fish with Matt Miller, who is the Regional Fisheries Management Coordinator for Fish and Game. I'm Charles Woolforth. It's been a funny year. We're pre-recording today, and a lot of the season is over. There's still people fishing silvers, and we'll be fishing silvers, maybe that picture is going to be a little bit better. But what's the story with the sockeye in Cook Inlet and in our rivers where we would see people drifting for them in the Kenai, in the upper Kenai, and then also the dip netting for them in the lower Kenai? How did that shape up, and do those issues relate to the king issues we were just talking about, or do we know?
Yeah, that's a great question. The sockeye, as I kind of referred to earlier, just was dismal this year. The sockeye returned to Cook Inlet, and specifically then to the Kenai, was, I think it was the lowest we'd seen in 30, 40 years.
Incredible, yeah.
And I haven't looked at it yet, but I was talking again to some research staff, and they were suggesting, again, from the scales that we look at, and most of that analysis is done postseason, but it looks like there was one of the age classes from the sockeye, too, were not really showing up as we had forecast. So that'll be interesting to see how that data comes together. It was dismal, and it impacted obviously the commercial fishermen. They didn't have very much fishing time compared to what they had in the past. Dip netters was pretty dismal. You'd hear the occasional story about somebody who was there at the right time. That, by the way, was not me. I went out and was not one of those people at the right time. And then in river, you know, people were flossing, as they will, fishing on the shoreline for sockeye. And pretty quickly on, we were getting phone calls saying, I'm giving up. You know, the sockeye aren't there. I'm getting more pinks at this point than I am. People were even catching coho, as they were typically fishing for sockeye or small kings. So
it was that throughout the whole Cook Inlet region? I mean, was it the same story? And we already mentioned that in Bristol Bay it was better, but sort of everything that's facing the Pacific, the North Pacific and the Gulf of Alaska, or is there exceptions?
Yeah, well, again, like we said, you know, there's exceptions out in the Bay, and I think that was pretty much the story Cook Inlet-wide. Well, now I say that, and then I'm going to talk about Kisilov, for example, which is just south of the Kenai, and looks like we're going to exceed the upper end of the escapement goal there. Hmm. And so the Kisilov, really, they have a hard time getting enough fishing power out front to really slow that one down. So there has been some opportunity out there. There was a good dip net fishery on the Kisilov.
Really?
Okay. So we even raised the bag limit there for the sport fishery in the Kisilov. So just south from the Kenai.
Really weird, isn't it?
Really, yeah, really difficult to kind of get your head around and figure out what's happening with that.
So Susitna Valley, we already did a whole interview about, but we were talking about, oh, it looks like it's going to be bad, and it was as bad as you expected or worse, huh?
Yeah, it was. And so we had restrictions preseason on there, and we had to take further restrictions for kings and, you know, meetings upriver and talking to folks about it. We also had this river this year that complicated things were some really high water events, which was probably good for fish passage. So anglers can't get out, river gets high and muddy, the fish have a better chance of getting through. So there's a lot of things going on.
Yeah.
This year.
And so we're now looking towards the end of the season. We're recording right here in the middle of August, and we're pre-recording. So some things will happen by the time we air this. But I've seen a lot of silver fishing down on the peninsula. Are the silvers looking like they have the same missing age class, or is it too early to talk about that?
Yeah, the coho are kind of our golden hope this year for the salmon. And with their life history, they go out and typically only spend 1 year in the saltwater, and then they come back, which is just amazing to me that they feed and
they grow that much.
Yeah,
right?
It's crazy. They get that big and strong.
I guess that's why they're so hungry all the time, huh?
One of the reasons they're such aggressive fighters when you hit them. And then last year, as you probably recall, especially with the Susitna drainages, this looked like the coho were coming into Cook Inlet, but they weren't moving up into those rivers. And by the time that they did, we ended up making most of those coho goals up in the valley, for example. But it was so late that the anglers really didn't have an opportunity to take advantage of them. Mm-hmm. School had started, people were out hunting, and so there wasn't a great coho fishery last year, and there's a lot of disappointed anglers. And this year, one of the tools that we have is the department's an offshore test fishery, and it's a boat that goes out and samples stations. And early, they were catching coho out there. And some of the commercial openers, the drifters out there were catching coho. So we were optimistic about that, and we're seeing them in the rivers. There's good fishing up in the valley. Sam Ivey, the area manager up there, has issued some emergency orders to liberalize, to increase the bag limits, which we're ecstatic about.
Yeah, really.
The reports down on the Kenai are pretty good. People are catching, I was just hearing, talking about that today, catching mostly their bag limits down there. It's kind of hit and miss. You know, you hear about the people who are missing them.
Still kind of early days, as we talk on the 14th of August.
Exactly right. Yeah, it's still early, but we're optimistic. Now, the danger is going to be that the coho were early and not necessarily a big run. And if the wheels fall off this, then we'll all be sitting here in late in August going, what happened to them? But I'm pretty hopeful that it was early and that we're going to keep seeing these in. So, you know, there's coho derbies coming up, and we're hoping there's going to be fish out there to keep those people going.
And it kind of gives you a sense of hope in that, like, there's, you know, each of the five Pacific salmon has a slightly different life cycle. And so different environmental impacts are going to hit them in different ways. And whatever happened that was so bad on the sockeye and the chinook, apparently it wasn't so bad on the coho because of the timing. And so that kind of gives us hope, well, in a couple of years, maybe we'll be back to normal with some of the other species.
And that's a great point, too, especially if you're looking at kings, which, as I said, you know, once they do that freshwater time and then they smolt and go out to the marine environment, 2 to 5 years out in the ocean when they come back. So that's a really great strategy for them. I mean, you could theoretically lose an entire age class and they would, you know, you'd feel that.
Right.
You know, don't get me wrong, farther down the road, but it would come back from that. It could recover from it. So it's a great strategy. And we think, you know, I know Charles, you and I talked about this before. as a department, what we try to do in cases like this is we'll try to limit the harvest and mortality where we can, and then try to ensure that we have good habitat. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, we're really fortunate as Alaskans that we have great habitat for these fish to come back to. So if those two things are in order, and as long as things aren't too totally askew out in the ocean,
right?
You know, we don't really think that this is the new normal. We think we'll start getting back up, and productivity will start climbing back up.
How have those ocean temperatures trended, and how did have you learned how to get those into your models for predicting how many fish are coming back, and or to start to look at like the ocean environment as well as the anadromous stream environment in terms of what you can predict?
Yeah, there's a lot of things, and I am not the one to talk about our forecasting. There's a lot of things that they look at, and I'm not sure that ocean conditions or temperatures are one of the things that we're able to model in very effectively yet.
Okay. Yeah, so it seems like there's a, even though we have been studying this fish for a century, right? It's their life is so complicated and the environment is so complicated that there's, we kind of know when they leave and then we know that they come back, but what happens in between, we're pretty ignorant about.
Yeah, we call that black box in the ocean. We really, I mean, like you said, and it's interesting with salmon as opposed to many other species, like, you know, rockfish, for example. With the salmon, they're relatively easy to study. You know where they're going to be and when they're going to be there, so you can set up.
Yeah, and you can identify them, right?
And you can identify them, right, you know, as opposed to, like I said, rockfish, where it's really difficult to go out, or many other species. So they're easy in some ways, but again, once they, you know, those anadromous fish, once they leave where we can see them and count them and go out, it's, we're not really sure. We're just kind of waiting to see what comes back.
We're talking about salmon, salmon and Cook Inlet, and on the Kenai Peninsula, especially with Matt Miller from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm Charles Walforth. It's Outdoor Explorer. There's been some discussion about the economic impacts of some bad fishing years on Kenai Soldotna area, and also on the, you know, the in the up in the Matsu area, and I'm just curious as to your perspective on that. You've probably seen it. I'm sure it's something that you're concerned about. Is that play into your decisions in any way, or do you have to just sort of put that to the side and like pretend it's not happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. You can't really kind of pretend it's not happening. I mean, we get a lot of phone calls about that because people are calling it. It's impacting their businesses. It's impacting their, you know, their kids' education. You know, people are fishing to pay for their kids. We're getting phone calls like, I went dip netting and I don't have any. I got 3 sockeye. You know, what
got
are we going
to
do?
Nothing to put in the freezer.
I got nothing to put in the freezer. So. It's in there. I mean, our main mission is to manage for these sustainable fisheries. You know, so the fish stocks and the sustainability of the fisheries is what comes first. There's also, though, the aspect of managing the resources of the state of Alaska in the best interest in the residents of the state. So that certainly plays into it. And one way you see that, for example, is with opportunities specifically in sport fisheries. One of the tools that we'll use is going from a harvest fishery down to a catch and release fishery, as long as the release mortality isn't going to drop us to dangerous levels. And one of the great benefits of that is not only does it allow Alaskans to go out, but it allows businesses. So if you're a guide, you can still book trips if you can catch and release. Mm-hmm. But once it's closed, you're done.
Right.
You know, and so there's some tools that are built in there that definitely try to take that into effect.
Yeah. So this year, it sounds like the commercial guys really got hit hard in Cook Inlet, set netters as well as drifters, I assume.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
And I guess I don't really know what happened with the seiners and pink fishing, but that's always this allocative sort of argument between the sport fishing and the commercial fishing guys and women. And I wonder if in a year like this, when there's a real paucity of fish, if that gets worse. I mean, if you sort of hear more of that, like, why are you letting the commercial guys take our fish and that sort of thing?
Yeah, we do. And that's another great question, because what a lot of Alaskans don't understand, and anglers, what they do know is that they care about the fish and they're very passionate about it. But the way that the way that it works is that the Alaska Board of Fisheries is a 7-panel board, and they're the ones who decide those allocation issues. And at the board meetings, the department's there, and we provide information and data, and kind of thinking of it as the department says, this is how many fish we think could be harvested, you know, just speaking generally. And then the board says, okay, well, we're going to give this many to commercial guys, this many to personal use, this many to. And And the priority is just for subsistence use. None of the other groups have a priority. And so the board develops management plans and regulations that we then try to follow throughout the season to meet their intent. So the Kenai specifically, you know, it was interesting because the management plan that's developed there says, look, in years when we have concerns about king salmon, for example, all the user groups are going to share this burden of conservation. So it's built into the plan that if the sport fishery goes to no bait, it reduces the hours of the commercial fishermen out front. And so as the restrictions to the sport fishery become stepped up, then the restrictions to the commercial fishery out front do too. So there's a sharing of the burden. People often refer to that as these paired restrictions.
And if you don't like it, go talk to the Board of Fish. Don't talk to Matt, because Matt's just applying the rules, right?
You know, you can talk to me for a while.
We won't do it again.
You can vent to me for a while.
I bet you hear a little bit of that, right?
And well, we do. And again, it goes back to the passion that the people have about these fisheries, the importance not only to their pocketbook, but, you know, to putting food on the table, to their spirituality. I mean, it's really a big part of who we are as Alaskans, this getting out and enjoying the outdoors and harvesting the resources. So I get it, you know, and I expect people when things
are strikes me, I mean, I'm sure you're educated as a biologist, but you also have to be a communication expert, because so much of what you do is just getting people, a lot of times, bad news. I'm sure getting the good news is easy, but a lot of times bad news is not so easy to give.
Yeah, that's it helps.
Yeah. So any outlook for next year, or a sense of whether the we've been talking about king and sockeye, silver's not too worried about if we see a turnaround?
Well, I think specifically for kings, like I said, we've, you know, the period of low productivity we've been seeing since about 2009, I think we're coming up out of that. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be the straight, smooth ride up the hill. There's going to be some bumps, and this year was definitely one of those bumps. And the bump this year, we'll probably see 3 and 4 years from now, some impacts as the result of it. And so the same thing with the sockeye. But
when you say bump, a negative bump.
Yeah, negative bump down a little, yeah. And probably the same with the sockeye. So I'm optimistic that we're going to that this isn't the new normal, like I said before, but it's not going to be an easy or smooth ride back up.
So next year might also be kind of a skinny year.
Yeah, I haven't seen the projections for kings. They'll come up with those sometime this winter. But I would expect, I would expect it hopefully to be good. I mean, last year was a good year. We had good numbers. We were making the goals. And then this year was a step down from that. So I'm hoping to see more like we saw in 2017 or better.
All right. Well, we will hope for that now in the long winter ahead.
Indeed.
Hate to even think of it yet, but but the fall is definitely in the air.
Yeah. Yeah, it's getting there.
Well, thank you so much, Matt. I really appreciate your coming in and explaining all this. Anything we should talk about that we missed?
I don't think so.
We covered it pretty well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Matt is the Regional Fisheries Management Coordinator for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And I'm Charles Wolforth. This is Outdoor Explorer. We're going to stay on this topic, so please stay with us.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. On an island about 4 miles off Kodiak, researchers are trying to figure out why Pacific cod stocks are crashing in the Gulf of Alaska, and how climate change may be affecting the fish when they're young. KMXT's Rich Borden caught a ride out with them on one of their trips and has the story.
Mike Litzo and his wife Alyssa Abukayer are stuck.
We have to get some kelp out, Liz.
They're trying to pull in a beach seine on a soggy gray day on Long Island, but they're catching more seaweed than fish as they slowly sink deeper into the shore's mud.
Oh no, it's the freaking mother load. Oh, this will be our day right here, if you're not careful.
This isn't a normal fishing trip. Litzo and Abukayer are both marine scientists, and they're collaborating on a study for the University of Alaska Fairbanks to figure out why Pacific cod stocks are declining in the Gulf of Alaska and how warming waters may be affecting the species when they're young. But to do that, they need cod to study, which is why they're currently struggling to pull in a net. When the seine's finally on shore, Litzo begins counting up the catch.
Oh, there's a fish.
Yeah, big dolly. I'm guessing. Nope. It's a greenling that Alyssa will identify.
There aren't any cod among the small flopping fish, but every specimen is still inspected and recorded before they're tossed back into the water. Litzo says he isn't surprised they're not catching any cod today because it's probably too early for them to come into shore. As it becomes warmer, though, more and more fish will begin to appear, including the small cod they're looking for.
So over the winter, you know, we would come out and we'd set five sets and we'd get, I think at the low point, like 15 fish. And then in the summer, if you hit a big school of fish, you know, you can get 15,000 fish in one set.
Once juvenile cod begin to show up in their net, Litzo and Abukayer will measure them, examine the fish to figure out what they're eating, and he says collect the small ear bones, or the otoliths, of the cod, which will be used to determine the temperature of the water the fish grew up in.
So there's all kinds of information you can get sort of over time once you catch the fish.
The reason it's important to collect this data is the Gulf of Alaska has been unusually warm for the past few years. In that time, cod populations have crashed. Cod is an important commercial fishery in the Gulf, and the quota was recently cut by about 80% for 2018. Litzo says the unusually warm water in the Gulf is connected to climate change. And, he believes, the reason the cod population declined so quickly is that juvenile cod couldn't find enough food to sustain themselves in these warmer temperatures. But that's only a hypothesis right now, which is why Litzo and Abukayer are trying to collect as much information that will help explain the collapse.
As you get a number of years together, you can start to understand something about how environmental changes are affecting the population. And that's the ultimate goal. But it does take a few years, you know, to get enough data to be able to answer questions like that.
Which means Litzo and Abukayer will hopefully be taking a lot more trips to cast their net to see what more they can learn about how cod are being affected by the changing climate in the Gulf of Alaska. In Kodiak on Long Island, I'm Mitch Borden.
As Outdoor Explorer continues today, we are talking about a fairly disappointing year of salmon fishing in South Central Alaska on the Kenai Peninsula. We've talked previously about the Susitna River Valley, and just talking just now with Matt Miller, who is managing those fisheries. And my next guest is Ricky Geese, who is the executive director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. I wanted to talk about the experience of anglers with these pretty severe restrictions and lack of fish and how that's affected the industry and the communities that rely on the fish. So really grateful to have Ricky on the phone with us. for this interview. And you're in Soldotna right now, Ricky, or Kenai?
No, we're in Soldotna. We're on the Kenai Spur Highway, right next to Sweeney's in Soldotna. We okay. have a new office and invite people to come visit us when they're in town.
Yeah. So I think there was some anticipation it was not going to be a great year for Kings. It was, I think, a little bit more of a surprise that it was as bad as it was for Sockeye. What was it like for you in terms of angling with the limitations and sort of the lack of fish that we saw?
Well, we had had concerns going into the season, and they came out as being justified. We were really supportive of taking very conservative management measures, given the kind of very weak returns that had happened in the Copper River and in Kodiak and Chignik as the season went on. The sockeyes were just not showing up, and the Kings, the early run of Kings on the Kenai was closed. We did not meet our minimum escapement goal, so we had very big reservations going on into July. And people were catch and release on king salmon, and we really didn't have a lot of fishing for sockeyes that was very successful. People were lined up on the banks fishing for sockeyes, and not a lot of catching going on. A lot of fishing, but not a lot of catching going on.
Yeah, the sockeye return, I guess, was really historically low, much lower than has been seen in decades. And that was a bit of a surprise, I think.
Yeah, it was a surprise. About a decade now, we're about a decade into it, we've just had really low returns for king salmon, both on the early run and the late run of king salmon. And those are mirrored throughout the whole state on the Yukon, the Kuskokwim, the Copper River down in Kodiak. I mean, so this is a statewide issue with king salmon. And many anglers have kind of transitioned over fishing for sockeye. So it's kind of a double whammy when the sockeyes don't show up. Both in the in-river sport fishery and then also in the dip-net fishery. I spent a few days out there straining water, just like the commercial fishermen primarily did when they were out, fishing. There's just not a lot of sockeyes coming back, and I think that caught a lot of people, including management, by surprise.
Yeah, there was actually quite a bit of effort put in, you were mentioning, with the angling for sockeye, but there were quite a lot of people down there dip-netting, but without a lot of success.
Right. I mean, I'm out there. I live right here, so it's convenient for me to go out on a boat and go dip netting. And, you know, we had the similar numbers in terms of participation to start off the season with. I was out there on the first weekend, and there were a lot of people out there, but it was anticipating some good fishing. And, you know, typically you might catch 20 to 25 fish in, 4 or 5 hours of out there fishing. People were catching 2, 5, 7. I mean, and this is all the boats out there. Nobody was really lighting it up. And there'd be little spurts that would come through, and you'd get a little excited, and then nothing. It was back to the drought. So it was very frustrating for a lot of people. I know on the bank fishing for dip netting, the city of Kenai had a lot less participation than what they had forecast. And as we went on into the season, into the dip net season, word kind of got out that it was very slow, and hence there wasn't as much effort subsequent to it.
So when people can't go fishing, they don't spend money, and they don't hire guides, they don't buy fishing gear and all the other things that a town like Soldotna really relies on to keep going. And I guess if the early Kings are completely closed, then that shortens the season dramatically, the tourist season. That's kind of obvious. I'm curious as to what the impact of catch and release is on the industry of sport fishing, because obviously at least Alaskans like to keep their fish, and with the catch and release in the water, you can't even really get a picture. How did you see that impacting the community and the industry?
Well, what you see is typically people like to harvest king salmon. That's why they come out fishing for kings. They're a great fish for sport fishing, but they're also a great fish for food. They're large. You catch one, and that's a lot of food to provide for your families, especially for Alaskans. When you take bait out of a fishery, that restricts or reduces the number of people maybe by 40%. So if 10 people initially go out fishing when there's bait and you can keep a king, And if you take bait out, but you can still keep a king, maybe six people go out. You reduce that down to catch and release, you know, maybe three people will go out, two or three people will go out. You know, it really reduces the effort. And we see that in the community. In the early run, they restricted where you can harvest king, so it's now only below the Soldotna Bridge, you know, where you can keep under 36 inches. But even that was closed in the early run. For between the Soldotna Bridge and Skelak, that shuts down two-thirds of the available area where people can go fishing. That restriction carried over into July, and then, you know, we went to no bait and then just catch and release. So a lot less effort for kings happening this year than they were in past years. That impacts our community significantly, whether they're guided fishermen or just Alaskans bringing their boat down, because it's primarily a boat fishery. A lot fewer boats on the river than we normally have. You know, we might have, you know, 25 to 30 boats on the river, different sections this time of year. We could have 300 on the river. And it's noticeable in town, whether it's in a restaurant, the lodges, shops like Trustworthy, Sportsman's Warehouse, Fred Meyer, you know, those places that that really provide a lot. I know over in the city of Kenai, a place like Three Bears, depends a lot upon dip netters coming down. All that was pulled back this year, and it's going to be a tough year for people.
Absolutely. Tough year for people not getting their fish, and also a tough year for those businesses and the people who work there, and then that dribbles through the whole economy. You said you support the conservation measures Fish and Game took, however, because you're thinking about it a little bit more long-term. What are the sort of long-term factors you see in, you know, making sure we still are able to go after these great fish?
Well, one of the things that we need to look at, obviously, is from year to year, you need to make your escapement goals. That's kind of what Fish and Game, you know, management in the state is based upon for salmon. And so we really support measures to make sure we try and make our minimum escapements. And, you know, we're worried because the runs were so low. We actually were thinking, you know, maybe we should step back on the pedal a little bit, both for the king fishing and the sockeye fishing, because these reports throughout the Gulf of Alaska were really so dire prior to July. Fish and Game did, you know, they allowed a little bit more harvest than we would have liked, but they scaled it back and were very limited and conservative in their fishing opportunity that they provided everybody. We may or may not meet escapement on the sockeyes, probably not. We may or may not, we've made the second run of king salmon, which is good. We didn't make the early run. So, you know, those conservative measures are important. Long term, however, we need some more research of what's going on in the ocean. There could be changing ocean environments in terms of water temperatures that are impacting all the fish, but there's also evidence about food competition. Are we putting too many salmon out in the ocean? Both, you know, primarily from, you know, hatchery production. About a third of the fish now being harvested in the state are hatchery fish. And if you look at the total abundance of salmon in the ocean, there's many fish out in terms of wild fish as there has been any time in the historical past. But layering on top of that, we have a third more fish just in terms of hatchery fish.
So that's an issue of, like, is there enough food for the kings and the sockeyes, plus all these pinks that are being put into the ocean by hatcheries in Prince William Sound and also in Cook Inlet?
Right. I mean, you've got this odd even year cycle, you know, a dominant year for pinks, then a weak year, and then a strong year, and a weak year, and it alternates back. And if you look back two decades, like researchers are currently doing, they're seeing a definite signature of when pink salmon are very high abundance in the Gulf of Alaska. The growth rates for sockeye salmon and king salmon are reduced. And this is a statewide issue for king salmon. And, you know, in the Gulf of Alaska this year, all the sockeye returns were struggling. And so, you know, we did make it on the Kasilof. The Russian seemed to be pretty good. But there's different age classes that need to be teased out. And the Kenai, you know, is definitely lagging behind, as was the Copper River early in the year. So we need to pay attention to what's happening out in the ocean. We need to have more research out there, and we need to just figure out where are the bottlenecks out there? What's causing this reduced in size for salmon across the state? What's causing the earlier age at maturity where where the females are coming back earlier, which means they're carrying fewer eggs. Hmm. And that doesn't portend well for the future. You know, they're weighing less. So to me, you know, part of it could be environmental in terms of water temperature, but it also could be too much food competition out there or a combination of that somehow. And those are issues that we need to start paying attention to with a lot more detail and funding to get it off the ground.
That's a really good point, Ricky. And my previous guest, Matt Viller, was talking about how they know a lot about what's happening in the streams. They know about when the fish are leaving, when they're coming back, but referred to the ocean part of the life cycle, which is the majority of the life cycle, is a black box. And I guess part of this puzzle, 10-year lag in poor king returns and now really surprisingly low sockeye returns, is let's open up the black box and figure out what's going on out there and see if there's things that we're doing that could be damaging those returns. So do you, in the past when we've had these issues of not enough salmon, there's been some conflict among the users in terms of the set netters, the drifters, and the sport fishermen. And I wonder if that has calmed down or if that's been a matter of concern for sport fishermen this year.
Well, it's every time, you know, you go into conservation measures, you know, sometimes people think, well, we should be fishing harder, we should be fishing less. You know, there's always a difference of opinion. And Fish and Game takes all that input, and then they craft their management with, you know, all the input from the different user groups. I mean, this summer we just felt very strongly that, you know, we don't have strong returns. We should really, you know, pull back on how hard we're fishing, both in river for the sport fisheries, the personal use fisheries, and then the commercial fishing industry. I think we've done some good groundwork at the Board of Fisheries. So, for example, in July for king salmon, when we have these low returns, I mean, even though we weren't fishing on them very hard this year, it's still probably going to be like the third lowest return for king salmon that we've had on record. And over the last decade, we've had, you know, 10 of the lowest years on record. So we need kind of these paired restrictions, share the burden of conservation. I think that we have that in place has kind of lessened some of the tension between communities. But then, you know, when there's not a lot of fish around, everybody's just kind of ornery.
Yeah, of course.
We all anticipate having fish, and we all enjoy fish. And when you don't have something that's really important in your life, you know, people tend to be kind of grumpy. But, you know, that's just life in a fishing community.
Absolutely. So in after 10 years of poor king returns and then a very poor year, have a lot of guides sort of left the industry? I mean, is it sort of shaken out a little bit in terms of a long-term change in the economic life of the community?
It has. I mean, people who were solely relying on king salmon for guiding from May, June, and July, whether on the Kenai River or the Kasilof, I mean, those guys don't exist anymore. They've already went out of business, you know, after 2012 and before that even. So we have probably about 30% fewer guides than we did about a decade ago. And those guys have really had to diversify in their kind of trip portfolio that they provide their clients. You know, it's much more emphasis, you know, making sure that maybe a trip on the upper river going trout fishing, or maybe some fly out trips to the west side of Cook Inlet, or maybe booking some trips to going out to go halibut fishing. The problem is when you have everybody coming in July kind of at the peak of the season, and the primary fisheries on the Kenai being, you know, the sockeye fishery and the king salmon fishery are greatly reduced in opportunity. There's only so much capacity for kind of these but other fishing experiences that don't have the big numbers that we do. They're just limited in capacity. So it's very difficult to kind of book those trips and to find seats in these other areas when the sockeye fishery, you know, was restricted down to one fish and then, you know, closed down. So
yeah. Just not that many options to go, and too many people. Absolutely. So,
yeah,
Ricky,
number one reason why people come down to the Kenai Peninsula is to go fishing, whether it's guided fishing or unguided fishing, both on the marine environment and in the freshwater fisheries that we have. Now it is kind of picking up in August. We you know, there's good silver returns throughout the inlet, whether on the west side up in the Mat-Su mm-hmm. or down here on the Kenai. People are limiting out on silvers fairly quickly, and you know, so I wouldn't put your fishing pole away just yet.
Yeah, that's it. The best part may be here to come.
Turning
yeah.
out to be a great fishery for silvers, and that could be a redeeming feature of this year's fishing season.
Absolutely. And I'm talking to Ricky Geese from the Kenai River Sports Fishing Association. I know you guys have focused a lot on habitat and on kind of connecting with other salmon advocacy groups, and that there'd be a more of a community of salmon advocates that are all sort of on the same page, and also reaching out to people to become connected with these fisheries and working in favor of salmon. And I'm interested if you can talk a little bit about that kind of work. That's not just about how many days of fishing we have or how many fish are returning, but looking at the bigger picture.
Sure. You know, we kind of live in a digital world these days, so we just put some resources into developing a new website. It's www.krsa.com, our acronym, Kenai River Sport Fishing Association.
Okay, so we'll put that up at outdoorexplorer.org, too, if folks want a link from there.
Yeah, that'd be a great link. And what we have is we have some different features on it. One, for anglers, we have a component called Fish Central, where we talk about what's going on in the Kenai fishing, the Mat-Su, Copper Valley, Anchorage area, and then also the marine fisheries out of Homer, Seward, and Prince William Sound. We also have a conservation section where we talk about the programs we do for angler access and conserving riparian habitat for fish, our fishery management stuff at the Board of Fish, the research projects that we help fund, and our education outreach programs. Then we also have, you know, a section to say, become an angler advocate. You know, we think that your voice matters, and as anglers and people, conservationists, we need to learn how to speak up for fish and our fisheries. And so we've made it very easy to sign up, just if you want to take action with us to become an angler advocate, just sign up, name, address, email. We also have a thing called text alerts. If you want to get an alert when there's an issue and we need put out a call to action for people, yeah, you can get it on your cell phone. So there's a lot of different features that we put on there. We also try to keep people informed. We have a blog where we talk about what's currently going on, and then we have a real news section where we look at statewide fisheries issues and also fisheries issues at the national level. Both engaging stories, you know, about fishing itself, but then also about the policy context in which your access and opportunity to go fishing is determined. And if we just encourage people to get more involved in that, mm-hmm. educate themselves. You know, fishing means a lot to people. It's something that's passionate. I mean, sometimes I think when you're ready to, you know, they say your life flashes before your eyes. You know, a lot of those great memories that you have that last a lifetime are in the outdoors, hunting and fishing with people that you care about. And there's just something kind of primal about that, and it registers in your life. And so, you know, for things that people are very passionate about, we want to provide them an opportunity to provide their voice along with other people so that people understand that when they're making allocation and conservation decisions on how to manage our fisheries.
Yeah. Are there areas having to do with habitat that you're particularly concerned about, or where you'd like to see where we have things that you're advocating for?
You know, on habitat, one of the things that we've done on the Kenai River is when we first started, back in the 1990s with habitat programs was a cost-share program between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and there's also a river center here on the Kenai, the Don Gilman River Center, where people can go and get all their permits, kind of streamlined permitting, and learn what the best practices is for riparian habitat along the Kenai River. There's probably about 2,000 property owners. You know, more than about 700 have taken advantage of that cost-share program through the years, so that's very satisfying. Another, you know, probably a third of the folks have done their own projects by themselves, but it's continual outreach. Those properties change hands every now and then, and you got new property owners, and it's kind of a cycle of education that we have in place here and that we're very strongly supportive of. On the big properties, you know, like the river, the community of Funny River on the south side of the Kenai River, they don't have a boat launch. You know, if you live in Nikiski, you actually have a boat launch closer on the Kenai River than somebody who lives right next to the Kenai on Funny River. Yeah, so we're working with that community to try and provide a suitable location to provide a boat launch. There's certain areas like Eagle Rock where State Parks has done a great job of putting a new boat launch facility in at Eagle Rock, and very easy for people to use, but it's got very limited parking. So we're looking at solutions to try and look at a long-term parking ways in which, you know, try and funnel traffic there, because it's off river. It's not right going right into the current. And if you're a new boater, or you may have a flat bottom boat, which is a little bit more habitat friendly, it's kind of difficult if you're trying to get in the pillars or some of the other locations where you're launching directly into the river itself immediately. So those are some of the habitat things that we've been looking at. We've also been working with CIRI. CIRI is the largest private landowner along the Kenai and down on the Kasilof Rivers. And we're trying to get people encouraged. You know, Siri's been very good as a neighbor and as providing access to anglers. And but they have a permit system now, and people can come into our office and get stickers. They're trying to encourage people to access their properties by boat and not by land, so they're not trampling across their property. And that's been very encouraging. That's been a good system. And, you know, that may spread to some other landowners also. So those are the type of habitat access projects that we have on the Kenai. Yeah, the Kenai is a special place. We probably have more angler access with light, elevated, penetrating walkways than any other location in the world. We also have more shoreline closed anglers probably than any other location in the world. You know, so it's a balancing act. You want to provide access. I mean, from the mouth of the Kenai up to Skelak Lake on any given day in a typical July when we've got good fishing in the river, you'd have 5,000 anglers. You know, fishing.
It's amazing. Yeah.
You know, 40 miles of river. So that's quite a bit of opportunity that people are looking at. And you want to have good public access places that where people know where to park. They know where there are restrooms. They know where to put their trash. And you got access points on and off the river that protect the riparian habitat, but allow anglers to get out and enjoy their passion for fishing.
Some good stuff.
Those are the type of projects that we do.
I feel like the culture is almost really developed around this environmental respect for salmon, protecting salmon, and you guys have a good part in that. And so thanks for that. And I want to thank Ricky Geese for being with us today. Even though it's been a tough year, silvers are looking up, and there's always next year, and so we always remain hopeful. Ricky is the executive director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. Thanks for being here, Ricky.
Thanks. I really appreciate it, Charles.
That's all for today's show. I'd like to thank my guest today. Matthew Miller was from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He's the Regional Fisheries Management Coordinator. Then we hear from Mitch Borden of KMXT talking about the crash of the cod fishery in the North Pacific. And finally, Ricky Geese from the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association talking about the problems with salmon fishing on the Kenai. A lot of bad fish news. Hopefully it'll be better next year. Producer on Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.